I'd just like to introduce our new Vice President, John. Well, I think you all know, and I'll hand over to you, John.
Thanks, Anne. Right, well, I was notified on return from my break after a trip up to the Blue Mountains that somebody had put my name forward and suggested that I would be more than happy to talk to you all about something. What I've come up with, and I hope it's going to work, is... hang on, I'll just set this thing up so I know where I'm going. The title I came up with was A Life Fulfilled. So I thought, well, that's something I can sort of talk about, gives it some sort of a direction, and actually ties into what I am doing here in Donald, etc. So basically, what my aim in life is to try to make life meaningful for myself. And I did a bit of a Google search to see what a fulfilled life actually meant, because I thought, well, if I was going to talk about it, I'd better know what it's all about. And amongst the categories that they came up with were that someone with a fulfilled life has many hobbies, activities and interests. Well, yes, I can tick that one. I fit that category. A sense of optimism and a sense of gratitude for what I'm able to give and what I'm able to take from others. Level of self-discipline, but being adaptable, being able to adapt to changing circumstances if and when it is appropriate. Be happy. Well, I hope I sort of managed to fill that category. I think some of the people in the med shed think that maybe some of my jokes are a bit ordinary, but hey. Sense of service to others, and I think it's fair to say that both with the work I do here and with the men shed and Meals on Wheels and some of the others, I try to look after the community as well as just myself, and also being able to make multi-level connections with people at all different walks of life, all different backgrounds and so on. So that's, I think, if you like, a broad overview of the way I've sort of tried to arrange my life, and hopefully am still doing it. I'll give you a little brief background of where I came from. I won't go back 77 years ago. I think that's a little bit too far. I don't actually remember too much of it myself. However, when I left school and started looking around at what I was interested in doing, my big interests were science engineering. So I ended up enrolling for a fellowship diploma in electrical engineering at RMIT. This was before RMIT became a university as such, and it was a course that was very much a practical oriented course that was beyond trade school level, but nevertheless did give me quite a bit of the background of the sort of things that are included in many of the apprenticeship courses, as well as being a full four-year post-matriculation subject. From there, I spent 12 months working at aeronautical research labs in something which has actually become fairly relevant recently. I was working in the hypersonic wind tunnel, and they were looking at the way in which hypersonic things such as cruise missiles and these things behave. So unknowingly, I was working in an area which, about 50 or 60 years later, has become quite relevant to society. Anyway, after that, I went to Monash University, and there, it's fair to say that learning and teaching and learning was far more theoretical than practical. But I had received a practical background during my time at RMIT. After Monash, I went up to the University of Newcastle got a diploma in education and also a master's degree. And that was where I would start to see myself looking at goal setting rather than just studying the general set of subjects. I was starting to concentrate on those things that were of particular interest. And I think in my case, it was a lot of involvement in computer-based studies and applications, which of course weren't around when I started at RMIT in 1964. It was the computers that in those days were sort of not quite what they were 15 years later. Upon leaving there, I started my professional life. I did some teaching, lecturing at what was Caulfield Institute of Technology, Swinburne College of Technology and RMIT, but decided to become heavily involved with an area which has been an ongoing interest to me, which is computer-aided instruction. Again, using computers, but trying to develop course material, actually in electrical engineering, but there was a significant grant from the then Victorian Institute of Colleges to try to basically find ways in which various colleges around the state of Victoria were able to make use of their computing facilities to help some of their students revise and get more practice at the work at what they were getting in lectures. We're talking about 1973 to 76, 77, so fairly early in the piece, and certainly well before Windows, well before really that the personal computer had even been invented, and we were having to develop graphical interface screens and give students the, you know, ways of answering questions in write down answers in English to questions, sorts of things that were considered almost impossible at that time. And that was one of the this is one of the things where I've sort of been talking about adaptability. I really enjoy taking on the impossible and then finding ways of achieving it. It's just one of my things. It's the way I love doing things that other people haven't been able to do. And that was one of the things that we were doing. So worked on that for a few years. Then, for various reasons, decided to move up to North Queensland, a place called Rolling Stone, north of Townsville. And there were a number of reasons for this, but I found that I was just putting in many, many more hours of work than I was certainly getting paid for, but also many, many more hours of work than were particularly good for my health. I was working, you know, sort of 70 hours a week on average, 60 to 70 hours a week, and not getting much time to spend with family, not getting much time to eat properly and to sleep properly and all of that sort of thing. So I decided that if I continued at that rate, probably I might be find myself in an early grave, and that wasn't what I really had in mind. That wasn't the sort of fulfilment I was really looking for. My wife and I decided to move up to Townsville. We tossed a coin. Whoever got the first job, we would move to that place, and the other person would move up and sort something out. She won. She got the job at James Cook University as a publications officer. I followed shortly thereafter to pick up a job at the university lecturing up there in electrical electronic engineering. However, apart from the lifestyle and spending more time with the family, I also felt that it was time I sort of became a farmer. Why not? Yeah, it was something else to try. So what we bought was...
Borders on the impossible.
So what we did was to buy a small farming property, but it was an operational mango farm. When I say small, we're talking, 14 acres in the old numbers. Wasn't a bad 14 acres because it actually had an absolute beach frontage. And was a long, narrow block, and there was sort of, the ability to go down there and swim or, go fishing, do whatever else I wanted to. But the mango farm was there, so I had to learn a little bit about growing mangoes. In those days, I have to say that there wasn't much of a... Well, let's say the market for mangoes in Australia was not nearly as well developed as it is now. Nowadays, if you didn't have 300 or 400 or 500 acres of mangoes, you wouldn't even bother. With about 14 acres, of which probably 6 or 7 of those acres were allocated to mangoes, was a very different sort of an opportunity. What we found out was that as we were living there, the mango market was developing, and the prices were falling relatively, per unit. And I thought, well, how can I make a business development opportunity out of this? So I spoke to a gentleman who was our, our marketing agent in Brisbane, and talked to him about things. And because I had such a small farm, I had the ability to do what the others couldn't. I was able to let fruit ripen on the trees so that you had the biggest, most flavourful mangoes that was possible to achieve, and to get them down there overnight. So I developed a market for deluxe, special, restaurant-grade mangoes delivered by order on an overnight delivery basis. So the agent would take orders from the restaurants that came to him, and we might get an order for 15 trays of a certain size of mango, 8 trays of a different size, or whatever they might be. Pick those mangoes that morning, wash them, process them, put them on an aeroplane, have them flown down to Brisbane. They were ready by 6 o'clock the next morning for the restaurant to pick up. It was just a niche opportunity, and I was getting, given that the cost of air freight, of course, was bigger than the rest, but all of the other costs were the same, whether I was picking them green and putting them in a thing or doing it this way. So I ended up getting around about 70% more return per unit than I would have if I was using the old system. And wasn't a lot of money, but it was an interesting business opportunity to try to work something out that, in what would otherwise be a falling market. Again, I just like doing stuff like that. It gave me the chance to really spend a terrific amount of time with the family. We used to do lots of things. We'd go fishing, we'd go for walks in the morning, we'd go collecting prawns when we, sort of the prawn season was there. Catch barramundis off the beach, whatever it might have been. That worked very well until the family split up, and the wife and the children decided to move back down to Townsville. And at that stage of the game, the mango farming didn't seem quite as enjoyable an option as it was before, so I started looking around. I had the opportunity to come back down to Melbourne and work again at RMIT. And one of my colleagues, who had in fact been involved with me in the online, or not the online, the computer education program, was working down there and had set up a thing called the Centre for Innovation Development. And I sort of thought, innovation, now that sounds interesting. This is the concept of taking a product from being an idea in somebody's head into the marketplace. In other words, it was a bit that looked at market opportunities, at industrial design, at going from basically an idea, working out all the manufacturing processing details and so on. And I found that to be a fascinating activity, and one in which particularly, this was mid-80s, by then we did have personal computers and we did have quite a bit of technology starting to develop, the first Apple computers, Apple Macintosh type computers were appearing, and it was an exciting time and involved all kinds of things, from a computer which was physically about the size of what you might say an iPad tablet, but designed for the blind. So instead of having screens and keyboards, it had a braille keyboard and a voice. And this was able to connect up, we didn't have an internet in those days, but it was able to connect up to other computers and allowed blind people to be able to interact with the outside world. And the guy who was developing this had a really fantastic idea. He decided to give a couple of them to a gentleman by the name of Stevie Wonder. And Stevie Wonder was, of course, going around the world and promoting this product everywhere he went. And that was a very successful product. Another one on a totally different level was stuffed trees. Somebody had come up with a weird and wonderful technology that allowed you to get a piece of a tree, a branch of a tree or something, somehow treat it so that instead of the leaves turning brown and dropping off, it would effectively preserve it. And you could have an indoor tree that didn't need watering and so on. As I say, I don't even know much of that. Certainly didn't use computer technology. But nevertheless, these were the sorts of variety of different things that we were playing with. From there, moved on to business consulting and business development. And a couple of us set up a consulting course, and or consulting company, and we were doing work for the likes of Ernst & Young and the various consulting and accountancy companies, working for them and providing them with the technical input they needed when they were picking up contracts to develop stuff for government programs or whatever it might be. That was, again, quite a challenge. One of them we picked up was to do some work. Many years ago, the Victorian government was trying to get a contract to develop, to build frigates, Australian frigates. This would have been, I suppose, the late 1980s. And I can't remember which accountancy firm, but they were given the job of trying to sort of develop a report which would show why Victoria was the ideal place to take this on. And we had a job of in about 3 weeks of producing a report that was that thick, with appendices that were that thick, to cover all of the things. And Victoria did in fact get the thing, and that's went down to the Williamstown dockyards and kept them going for about 15 years. So again, lots of different things, but technology based, and things that I found challenging and interesting. When that started to run out, I decided, well, we now had an internet. I was interested in computer-aided instruction. Let's have a look at online education. Computer education, but using the latest technologies. Went back up to North Queensland and worked for the place thing called the Centre for Interactive Multimedia up there, which was developing material, again, just pre-internet, but we were developing courses on CDs that provided interactive education for teacher training. there's a thing called the Remote Area Teacher Education Program, which was designed to get kids, girls particularly, in some of these Aboriginal settlements to be able to learn the skills they needed to become teachers within their own communities. And my job there was at the technical side again, how to get the idea, turn it into something, get it onto a CD, get the CD working in a computer in such a way that the product could be delivered. So it involved lots of things involving animation, colours, audio and all these sorts of things to make things interesting for the recipients so that they weren't bored to tears trying to learn something off a blackboard and so on. I was dragged, headhunted and dragged back to RMIT as a result of this. The arts faculty at RMIT had picked up some money to set up an internet, online internet-based course in art education and how to apply all kinds of different things in, we're talking not just graphic art, but sculpture and design and all these sorts of activities. So again, I came down to that. I found the difference between working in Townsville at the Centre for Interactive Multimedia and working at RMIT in the art faculty to be around about 100% increase in salary. So there was something, a message in that somewhere. Anyway, got that up and running, and at this stage, RMIT University, as it was at this stage, decided that what they felt had necessary, a big institution at that stage, they had something like 38 to 40,000 students all up, and they had something like 2,500 different courses. And they decided that what they wanted to do was to have at least 50% of their offerings available online. So all of a sudden, you know, from sort of one-on-one, we're suddenly talking about a huge activity. And what was necessary was to develop what they tend to call the back office, the bits that you don't see, but the bits at the back end that have to link all of these things together. And my job was to find a way of linking all of these 40-odd thousand students and all of these, well, I think we had about 1,000 courses we sort of started initially, and have them all linking in, all running different technologies, different programs, but have them all working in the background so that what the students were doing could be entered into their academic records and so on. And that was an interesting challenge. Again, nobody had ever done it in the world before. And in fact, we had the people from Microsoft came out and offered to give RMIT lots and lots of money to tell them how it was done, but RMIT decided to keep that information. So I was working very hard and got all of the background systems up and running and developed the technology to do this. Then they said, okay, we're going to turn the switch and we need somebody to be the day-to-day manager. You're it. I said, no, I'm not. I had absolutely no interest in being the day-to-day manager. My interest was being at the breaking edge, you know, to look at the new opportunities and so on. When it came to being a pen pusher behind a desk, that wasn't for me. So I had to find something else. What I did, I looked around at RMIT at the time, had a virtual reality centre. Now, we're now in probably 1996 or thereabouts. Virtual reality was a huge academic thing. Everybody was into virtual reality. It was terrific. You could do all this and you could do all that. What are you going to do with it? Well, I don't know. It's just terrific. So I came in there as, if you like, business development manager. And my job was to get this virtual reality stuff and to try to turn it into business opportunities. and we managed to pick up a few things. We got some of the exploration companies who were looking for ways of using some of this information to dig down into data for mineral explorations and so on. And they were able to effectively walk through areas which had been photographed from above, have a look at it at ground level and see what it was all about, and find out whether or not some of these were areas that was appropriate for prospecting. We were working with the Queensland Water Supply Authority if they wanted to build a dam, to have a look at where the dam would go, how big it would be, how deep it would be, how much water would be there, what the applications were. The most interesting one was New South Wales Railways. They ended up buying their own VR centre at about $150,000 or $200,000 based on what we had given. But we developed for them a complete virtual reality model of one of their underground stations. I think it was Museum Station, I think, on the loop there. And what we decided to do was to bring a train into the thing, but the train was on fire. There was a fire in one of the carriages. Now, one of the technical aspects, if you've got a fire and it's in a closed carriage, there's a lot of smoke and a lot of combustion there, but it's got low oxygen. With the trains in New South Wales, when the driver pushes the button, all the doors open at once. So the train pulls into the station, the driver opens the thing up, all of a sudden air washes in, and all of a sudden this thing almost explodes. There's flames and there's smoke and there's noxious gases and things starting to fill the platform. And the idea was to teach prospective station managers how to try to clear the platform, get people out without as many dead bodies, or with as few dead bodies as you can manage. And they decided it was better to do this in virtual reality than in real life. I could never understand this, but the thing was, we were using the science and the technology of the fire performance, because that had to be done at a theoretical level, but combine it all in but make it so realistic, with people running around, and this guy had to sort of try to work out which barriers to open, which ones to close, how to get people out of the platform in the minimum time. That sort of thing was really interesting. I love the idea of turning a theoretical thing like virtual reality into real commercial business opportunities. Then I had to retire. Oh, unfortunately, RMIT were going through a fairly poor financial thing. They weren't renewing contracts, so my contract expired, and that was the end of me. But I wasn't done yet, so I decided to try something totally different. Moved down to Tasmania, found ourselves set up basically as an art gallery and studio. But it was a beautiful building, and decided, you know what, we could turn this into a bed and breakfast. So we did. Bought the property, put on a couple of extra rooms onto it. It had one room there for guests, which I think was for visiting artists. Put on another couple of rooms and set it up as a bed and breakfast facility, and also art gallery, and also cafe-restaurant. It was located fairly close to Devonport, so we had the ability to capture the market for people who came up across on the Spirit of Tasmania on the day sailing, because they'd arrive in just on dark and really wouldn't want to have to drive to Hobart or to Launceston or anywhere like that, and also for the day sailings in the return direction, because the boat would leave at about 7 in the morning, and people could stay with us, and then we'd give them breakfast and get them onto the boat. Very, very successful development, but we were starting from a zero level, in other words, had nothing going. But worked that out, also managed to become quite successful with the cafe and restaurant, and we ended up doing quite a few weddings and such things because we had the three rooms available and also were able to have wedding arches and all that sort of stuff. So built that up quite well. But then my wife's family decided, they lived in Melbourne, they decided they were getting a bit old and really needed someone to look after them, didn't they? As a result, one of us had to be over in Melbourne all the time while the other one was in Tassie. And running a B&B as a single individual becomes a bit... It's not much fun. You're 7 days a week from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. without a break. So that became sort of less desirable at that particular point of time. But a few people asked me what I'd be done, and I sort of had the idea that I'd really move from virtual reality to actual reality. I thought that was sort of where I could see myself. Anyway, we eventually sold that business and moved back to Victoria. I then started to get into a number of different online activities. The business side of the internet had now reached a stage where it wasn't just the Wild West anymore. There were real business opportunities and real activities that people could get involved with and so on. And also became fairly interested in the aspect of travel, because travel is one... Barbara, my wife, has been involved in the travel industry for years, and we decided to get involved, and we had contact with a number of people who were offering courses. They'd run seminar series of 2 or 3 days and have people, they'd come into a hotel and they'd sort of, you know, book into the hotel, they'd spend 2 or 3 days learning about something, and then they'd go off and disappear into the wilderness. And we spoke to a few of these people and said, look, you want to put them on a cruise ship. A, you're giving them something which is really memorable for them, and B, they can't just bugger off, can they? So we set up a business called Cruise Marketer, and what we were doing was going around and selling the idea of helping people to run their events on cruise ships. And that became very successful. We were getting, for instance, some Australian customers to go on cruises that ran out of the United States or out of Europe. You know, they'd fly over there, get onto the ship, be on there for 7 days, 10 days or something. And it worked out very, very well for both the people who were presenting the course, who were, of course, our clients, but also the customers of the people, because they had a real chance to concentrate on building up their business. You know, they couldn't go and do other things, so that they sort of did a lot of work on brainstorming and so on. Anyway, that worked out well. Then I decided, well, I've never written a book before. You know, one of those things, maybe you should write a book. So I did. And I've got a book here, Get Packing, the Ultimate Travel Guide. And we produced this book, which has some very, very useful information for people, whether they're travelling within a country or internationally, travelling on planes, boats, buses, cars, etc. And in fact, I've got a batch of them here, and I'd love to give you each a book, because I've got a box of them. I've got to get rid of them, so please grab one on the way out if you're interested. I made one error with that book, and that is that the quote on the front is from a guy from Flight Centre Business Travel. And the reason he's on there was because the publisher of the book said, yes, I've got contacts at Flight Centre, and what we'll do, we'll get Flight Centre to buy the books, give them to their clients, you know, as part of a, you know, we give them your ticket and we give them a copy of the book. They didn't, did they? And of course, because it had that on the front, I couldn't go to other estate and other travel agents, so I ended up with 5,000 books that I couldn't sell. Not wood. Therefore, I've got about 400 of those boxes. Anyway, yeah, please grab a book. You'll find it a good read, if nothing else. Everything was working fine there until Barbara decided she didn't really want to live in the same place as me anymore. We're in a situation then where we had a house, lovely house in Furniture Gully, we just moved into. It had to be sold. And we sold the house, took the money, the bank sort of grabbed its bit, and we looked at the little bit that was left, shared it out 50-50, and I sort of thought, well, what am I going to do? As I say, I'm a born optimist. I wasn't game to just sit back and say, oh my, how things are bad and so on. I've got to find something to do. I want to make something more of my life, and I want to do something meaningful, but I can't afford to do it in Melbourne with the money I've got and with how much it costs to live. So the idea was to start looking around for somewhere where I could afford to purchase somewhere to live with the money that was left. And turns out that with the amount of money I had left, 300 kilometres radius of Melbourne seemed like a good idea. Anything closer than that, and there was no way known it was going to work. So I really wanted to find a new opportunity, so I started looking around, and I spent probably the best part of 2 or 3 months travelling around the state at about a 300 kilometre radius. When I went down to Gippsland, it was about a 400 kilometre radius, so prices were still high, much closer to 300 k's. Anyway, went around, probably looked at about 20 or 30 different communities, and as I was going through Donald one day, I sort of had a bit of a look around, and I sort of, yeah, it was a good size, it had lots of infrastructure, people were very friendly, and then I started reading up on it and discovered how, if you like, entrepreneurial this town is. We've got things like the shirt factory. It was going to close down. Locals came in and put some money into it and kept it going. We had Cooker's Country Cookies. Similar thing happened. We've got, what's the name of the food company? Could have been set up in Melbourne, but set it up in Donald. You've got a workforce that's much more committed to the whole thing. So really, there's this sort of a... Donald's the sort of place that's going to work to come up with what the people in Donald want. They're not going to sit down and moan and groan and say, oh, how sad it is, what are we going to do? This was the sort of place I wanted to be. Come to Donald, put my heart and soul into the place. What is vice president here, is it? President of the men's shed. I really love the idea of contributing to the community, trying to do the best I can to help the community to survive and to develop. And really, that's the reason, that's why my fulfilled life has got me to Donald at this particular point of time. And that's about it. I have two daughters, one of whom lives in the Gold Coast in Queensland, and the other of whom lives in the Blue Mountains. At the time that I was looking for somewhere to live and decided on Donald, the one who's now in the Blue Mountains was living in Melbourne and said she'd come up here and help me do this and do that and do the other thing. I signed the contract and she said, guess what, I'm moving. have one granddaughter who's 27 years old and she's currently working in Sydney. But I also have my relationship with Barbara is very, very good indeed. So I've also got the adopted family, if you like, the stepchildren and step-grandchildren. And I am feel very grateful to have that sort of interaction with that. So they're my step-family, if you like. So that's where things are. And as I say, you know, I'm here doing what I can. Barbara's doing her things in Melbourne. We're still both very happy.
Okay, thanks,
John. That was really good. I enjoyed that. Okay, well, we'll set up John's book here. And we've got some tomatoes.